Quantum phase estimation. So let me start by giving some background, like how quantum phase estimation look like in the context of quantum metrology, mainly to people in quantum optics, let's say, and how it looked like until maybe 10 years ago. So this would be the standard Runge interferometry, which is the easiest way to do quantum phase estimation. And if you just start with some product state, so you have a bunch of spins, and you put every spin in a superposition of up and down, and then you evolve with some, this is a policy, with some zero rotation. And when you evolve it, every one of these states, because it's in a superposition, we got some relative phase, and then you measure some phase. For instance, you do an X measurement on all the spins, and you're trying to estimate this phase, which will be often like a frequency with some time. And this is the uncertainty that you get on the estimation of the phase. So this will be standardized interferometry. That's what is done, for instance, here on NIST. This is the cesium atomic clock, and it's a, sorry, the NIST atomic clock is a cesium quantum. So you prepare like some cesium atoms there, you throw them up. Here, in this microwave, they go into a superposition of a spin up and down. They evolve for some time, they acquire some phase, and then when they come back, you measure this phase. So in a way back, this amounts to the next measurement, and you estimate the frequency, and therefore you use this as an atomic cloud, as the way it works. So what people realized some time ago, maybe in the 70s, is that if you could... Oh, yeah.
It's for the number of atoms, what's new?
Thanks for the question. New is the number of factors.
Repeat this experiment. So yeah, N is the number of atoms we have here. And then you can do the experiment new times. And this will be like the uncertainty you get. If you, so what people realized in the 70s around is if you could prepare an entangled state of these cesium atoms, where instead of being, you know, in a product state superposition up and down, they will be all up and all down. So this is a cat state. Then you will get a phase which is n times bigger than the phase you get with every one of them. And if you do the same thing, and here new again is the number of times you repeat this experiment, then you, what you get is an improvement on the uncertainty of the, of this frequency you're trying to measure. So instead of going with the square root of n, n being the number of atoms you have here, it goes with m, and you know, this is a quadratic improvement, and people normally refer to this as the Heisenberg limit, and it's due to the entanglement, and it's a quantum effect. So people have been trying to pursue this for some time. And that's the main idea, I guess, of quantum metrology, or it was until not so long ago. And there are many systems where people have been studying this kind of effect and implementing them experimentally, like atomic spin squeezing, Meissner interferometer with optical annular states, DEC interferometry, stuff like that. So what you would like to do to perform this is to replace this microwave cavity with some magic box that prepares a superposition of, you know, all up and all down, which is obviously very hard, and which is the reason why this is not so useful, or hasn't turned out to be so useful for real experiments or for real metrology, where you really want to estimate a parameter to the biggest possible precision. But if you could do it, then you get the speed up. So what I want to do now is, so we have this simple picture. What I want to do now is explain how this picture, I think, has been changing lately using tools coming from quantum computation, and it's not that clear anymore that, you know, this entanglement, well, the entanglement certainly gives you the quadratic improvement, but you can do things without entanglement that sort of have the same scaling. And it's not so clear, it, you know, this is not quantum anymore, and this is just classical. So let me explain how that works. So what happens in quantum computation is, well, this is one of the first things, and most important things, I guess, in quantum computation, which is Kitaj's phase estimation, or general phase estimation. And it's actually a BQP complete problem. So if you could do this with some classical means, they give you a description of U, and you can estimate, well, you put some eigenstate here, let's say, and it will acquire some phase. And if you can estimate this phase with some classical means, then you could do any problem you can do with a, you could do with a quantum computer. So, and it turns out to be optimal. So this will be like a reference for it. This thing be BQP complete. And this is the reference where they prove that this kind of circuit is optimal, with some subtleties having to do with the cosmos and things like that, that I'm going to jump over. And the way it works is, well, for the simplest case, you just prepare some eigenstate here, and there is some control of the unitary that is generating the faces. And this is just a Hadamard, so you go out in a superposition of all the states in the computational basis. And well, there's, you know, this is a control, so you will acquire faces here, then you do an inverse Fourier transform, and you estimate that phase. And that's the way you do quantum phase estimation in the context of quantum computation. So let's analyze this a bit more. What happens is, well, this is the inverse Fourier transform. That's the Fourier transform, which looks like this. And you just want to do the inverse of this. Let's not get into the details. But if you just do the inverse of the Fourier transform, this is what you're doing. This is a piece of that. So you will have some Hadamards and these controls. These are just spaces that you're putting here, more Hadamards, and then you measure on the C basis. So if you do what is called the principal or deferred measurement, and this was, I guess, introduced here in another language, if it's a new, which is basically this circuit that you, the semi-classical Fourier transform, what you're doing is instead of controlling under measurement, well, if you're going to measure, then you can just do the measurement first and then control classically. And these two things give you exactly the same result. So if you do that, then this inverse Fourier transform doesn't look less quantum because all the controls are now classical. And these qubits, at least on this part of the circuit, are not coupled. So, well, these phase controls here, in the process of doing quantum phase estimation, all they are doing is phase feedback, which can be important to obtain the good limits, you know, the limits of the amount of resources you want to use to do the phase estimation. But it's not critical to get like the fundamental Heisenberg limit that we're interested in. These are papers dealing with how to do these controls, like Neil Ortiz and Soma. And this paper is an experimental paper that has been accepted in Nature. And what we're going to do then, because we're arguing that this is not fundamental for this speedup that you get on the quantum phase estimation, well, I'm not going to worry about these phase controls. So we go back to the original circuit, and we have replaced that. It turns out that if U was an eigenstate of this unitary that is encoding the phases that we want to measure, then all the qubits on the top, right, are not entangled. They are basically a product state. And because the Fourier transform we saw that is not coupling these qubits either, well, you can basically just do the estimation one ancilla qubit at a time in this particular case. And because this is what happens in quantum metrology, then we're going to use this simpler quantum circuit.
That literally works when you're using, you're just sort of saying that you really do all that stuff, but you're just sort of abbreviating it in a diagram. I think I don't understand how you're simplifying it. The inverse Fourier transform.
So the simplification I have done is this is the inverse Fourier transform,
okay.
And you just do the classical controls.
Okay.
And I am saying for like simple cases that you're interested in quantum, where the state that is coming from here is a product state, right? This coupling is now classical. So if you come in with an eigenstate, you can basically estimate one bit of the phase at a time. And then just repeat the experiment and estimate the next bit. So you only need one qubit at a time.
Sure.
On the part of the Fourier transform.
But you have to do the controlled Rx, the classical control, don't you?
You have to do the control Rx, but what I was trying to argue is that the control Rx is not really the fundamental reason why this thing works. Or, you know, or I'm just simplifying the circuits. So you can think the controller X is there, and I'm just not going to write
that. Because saying the cost is somehow insignificant to this classical control,
yeah.
You just don't mark it.
Yeah, so if you need to do the controller X, you can do this, you just leave it there. But that's not the part of the circuit. So then we're back, you know, we're in this circuit, and
yeah, you can have a controller X here that will depend on the outputs of previous measurements. And I'm not going to deal with it. You can just carry it around. And then what happens now is very simple because you only have one qubit and you have this unitary that is giving you one phase, and this is an eigenstate. So for simple case, like in quantum metrology, if you know this eigenstate or if you know, you know, if you have access to two eigenstates of this unitary, this logically just seems like a C rotation again. So, well, you're just controlling a C rotation, and all that you're doing here is just putting the phase on the top qubit, right? So the argument I'm making here is quite simple. It's just forgetting about the phase control that you will put there, this complicated circuit for the simple case of quantum metrology is just a very simple sequential protocol where you can apply this unitary to the qubit a number of times depending on the particular bit of the phase that you're trying to estimate. And the point is that once you get here, well, this looks pretty much like the Ransi protocol you have at the beginning in the context of quantum optics. So this doesn't look like, you know, a very quantum protocol anymore. But we started with a circuit that was optimal for phase estimation and, you know, cross functions. So this thing is also optimal, being, you know, just simple, a simple sequential protocol for phase estimation.
And then you measure that phase. The time you load the volume could be this gauge here that puts in the meter of the phase that are trying to estimate. You may need to do some phase feedback at the end. But this circuit basically gives you the optimal state. Not only can I do anything. So, well, I guess this is, you know, a bit of a different picture than the one you have for quantum optics, in the sense that in quantum optics, you had an entanglement at the beginning of this was supposed to be the great thing that was giving you this quantum effect. But if you follow this argument, then this other very simple circuit that is just classical Ransi interferometry also gives you an optimal scale for these simple cases. And thus,
I don't understand that. So, I mean, if the general problem with that circuit is optimal for the general problem, I don't see how a simplified problem is necessarily optimal, like it might be that there is some more optimal solution for a special case.
Well, this will be optimal for the general problem of architecture systems. So, you know, you need to start with negative state here. And otherwise, arguments will break. But in the problems of quantum control, you know, that people in quantum optics have been interested in, that you're actually in the parameter of this state, then you can do it this way. That is successful for that, you know, particular subset of problems. But not.
We'll revisit this later.
Okay. So.
All right, the reason why I went through this route is because we're going to be using this sequential protocol now. And what we're going to do with this sequential protocol is, well, you know, you have simplified. This is actually what they do in this paper, Higgins et al., that has been accepted in Nature, you know, just recently. But anyway, once you get here, well, maybe you can do something even simpler, which is, you know, you just have this one qubit to do all the estimations. So the question is, can you do something with DQC1 and maybe put in there more generic unitaries. Well, let me explain this step by step. Oh, actually, I forgot this is fine. Okay, so yeah, we have this this sequential protocol. You can also relate it back to the entangled protocol, and you can do this with circuit identities. And the way you do this, well, is this simple circuit here prepares a Bell state. So these are the cut states you want to have for the entangled protocol of this estimation. And this identity is very simple to check, too. All you're doing is if you have some C phase applied to the some qubit there and a zero coming here, well, it's the same as doing controls, applying the C down there and then doing controls again. So if you have the sequential protocol, then you can come here and do your cut state, apply the gates in parallel, and do some measurement at the end, which is basically the measurement you need to do for the cut state protocol. So the only argument I'm trying to make in this slide is that, you know, from this point of view of circuit identities, both of these protocols are also identical. And okay, so we have that. This is just, you know, parallelization of quantum circuits that has been studied in the context of just making quantum circuits running shorter time. And that's actually kind of the advantage you get with entanglement protocol, and is that you don't need. So in the case that you're trying to estimate a parameter that is changing rapidly, if you do this entanglement and you parallelize it, then, well, you can do better because the parameter might change. And this allows you to do the estimation in a shorter time by just parallelizing. Okay, so we have these formal identities, but the question is, are these just formal identities, or is there any physics behind these identities? So one thing you can do is put the coherence, which is something you will have in any physical process, and see if both protocols behave the same way or not. Because you might think that, you know, the sequential protocol, they're just applying this gate sequentially, there's an entanglement anyway. So maybe this protocol is better from the point of view of, you know, if you have decoherence from noise, this is more robust, you're better off using that. So it turns out not to be the case, and this is the way you can solve it. You just introduce a projection operator in the xy plane, And the reason to do that is because we're doing rotation on the z-axis, so all the faces information will be on the xy plane. And then you have some channel that is basically your noise. And we're going to take this channel to be uncorrelated and to be symmetric around the z-axis, because that's, you know, where the face is going to be. And uncorrelated just because otherwise it's hard to compare these two protocols. So if you do this, you know, what happens is that if you have your projector operator and then this decoherent channel, this is all you can get for this generic kind of channels. You just get some contraction on the xy plane, some defacing, and then, well, you can get some random phase that will be just noise. And that's all it will happen. So if you do this trick with a sequential protocol, and you're finally going to be measuring x or y or something on the xy plane, so it's legitimate to put this projection operator here, and then you just move it around, well, then you just get a decoherence that works like this. The contraction gets the nth power, and the random phase gets multiplied by n. Your gate is just n times bigger, and you're going to be projecting the initial state. And this is a mathematical identity. So that's just characterizes completely for this kind of channels the noise that you will have on the sequential protocol. If you go back to the entangled protocol and do the same thing, well, the same thing happens. You just now have a tensor product of these qubits. And if you put the projection operator through, it's just a tensor product of them, but then you have the n channels acting at the same time. So you just get the same thing, the n coming now, not because you're applying the channels sequentially, but because you have a tensor product of the channels and you're applying them in parallel. So it turns out that the decoherence is exactly the same in both protocols. So it's not only that they are, you know, equivalent from the point of view of doing quantum circuits, they are also equivalent from the point of view of the noise that you will expect if you're trying to use them for phase estimation. And one simple way to understand that is you can write the cut state that you're using on the entangled protocol as this expression here. This is not important because there won't be any phase there, but this is important. That's where you're going to get the phase. And it's just a tensor product of these things, x plus iy. And when you expand this out, then you will have poly strings of size n with x and y. And if you put this channel, well, every one of them is going to decohere with the same rate, but you have a string which is size n. So the total decoherence rate is going to be, you know, to the nth power. And that's one way to understand where this thing is coming from. So what we're saying is that the sequential protocol is equivalent also from the point of view of what happens when you put noise into the system. And now to the mixed state estimation. So we have this sequential protocol, and this is how it looks like. That's the circuit that I introduced, simplified, standing from the complete circuit that you use for phase estimation. And well, this will be the circuit for mixed state quantum computation, which was introduced in this paper, Nina Laflamme. And what happens here is you just have one ancilla that is pure. This is one example of them. Then you have a bunch of n qubits which are in the totally mixed state. You apply some unit iron. In the simple case, you apply this control W. And if you do this operation with a Hadamard here and you measure here the expectation value of Sx of Xy, then it turns out that it gives you the trace of this W there. And it's doing so more efficiently than any classical algorithm. So this circuit, even though it has a lot of noise, is very efficient to calculate trace of unit iron. So one thing we can try to do is, well, now we have this simple circuit that kind of looks like this one, except that you cannot prepare an eigenstate. One natural idea is, can we try to use this to do phase estimation and implement the sequential protocol there? And because the main problem is that you cannot prepare eigenstates of U anymore, you just have this mixed state, there is something else we can do, which is go to the Heisenberg picture, and that is, instead of looking at U as some unitary that is rotating some states, we can look at U as a unitary that is rotating some operators, right? And if we look at the unitary rotating operators, and then we take the trace with some other operator, well, it turns out to be the standard Hilbert-Smith inner products for these operators, right? So if this operator has rotated with some phase that depends on the unitary, and you take the inner product, if you think of this space of operators as a vector space, which it is in general, it's a Lie algebra in general, which is also a vector space, then this inner product will give you an estimation of how much you have rotated this operator in the space of operators. And because this trace is precisely the thing that you can implement with a Mises state quantum computation, then maybe you can do that with Mises state quantum computation.
Well, here there are just, you know, generic operators, and the B is the operator that you're rotating with you. And the this one here is a bar operator, and you're just doing the product between them. So the B is, if you think of them as vectors, in some vector space, the vector space operator, then you rotate B, and or could be some other axis. And if you knew the angle they had before, and you're rotating them, and take the product again, that will tell you like how much the angle has changed, and from there you can estimate the place.
Yeah, I understand the geometry of this vector space. What I don't understand is how right-hand side is related to the operational circuit. So, you know, W is some circuit.
Here is W stuff.
So what's how do B and O fit into this
that's
operational picture?
That's where I'm going.
Oh, that's where you're going to put it. Okay.
So this is just like the generic idea of why do this space work. And now you have to see if it actually works, right?
So this is what you can do. Well, imagine this is your unitary. That's the frequency you're trying to estimate. This is the time that you can control. And this is some Hamiltonian, some generator that you know a lot. So if you can decompose, sorry, if you can find another operator in this in the algebra of operators in this 2n qubit cell here, such that when you start commuting with this knot, they form an SE2 algebra. So the standard, you know, spin algebra of X, Y, and Z, this is a similarly algebra, has the same commutation relations. If you find that, if you can find an operator with that property, then this circuit will give you the cosine of 2 omega t, and these are like the V and the O in this particular case. So all you have to do is H knot that you know about, and you can think of it, you know, as some abstract Z operator or some abstract X operator, and you find some abstract Y operator in the sense that they have the same commutation relations as the standard X and Y. And if you find those operators with the same commutation relations, then this is true because this just depends on the operations in the algebra. So as long as the commutation relations are the same, this identity works. Yes, it will work with X, Y, and Z. And therefore you get some number here, which is which depends on the frequency that you're trying to estimate, and you can still control this time. So the point is that you can use this, or you would expect to be able to use this, at least in abstract, to do an estimation of omega using the sequential protocol. But then, of course, the problem might be that these operators still might not be unitary operators. They are just operators in the algebra. So, well, what you can do then is you expand them in terms of polyproducts, which you can always do because polyproducts are a basis for these operators. And if you have L of them for H1, then you will need to calculate all these inner products, which are L squared of them. But this doesn't scale with T. So you can still use this, you know, it's kind of inefficient depending on the size of L, but you can still use this to estimate this cosine 2 omega T. And if you keep increasing time as you do in the sequential protocol, then you're going to do this with a scaling that will go like the scaling you got initially with the cat state protocol. So you just run L squared times this circuit. This circuit actually implements this operation here, and that's basically the question before. You just need to put some control of this polyproduct, the unitary there, the control of this other polyproduct. There will be a U that are here, which you really don't need because you're not measuring there anyway. And the point is that this simple circuit here implements this inner product, and if you know all these inner products for different polys, then you get the cosine of 2 omega t, and from there you're going to estimate the omega.
I'm just trying to parse that. Like, the H1 is U and O. Like, from your previous slide, you had these U and these V and O.
H1 would be on the previous slide. This is just in general. Like, I'm not saying anything about what these V and O are, other than, you know, they're operators on the other operators, so some Hamiltonian.
Okay.
Hermitian operators.
So they're Hermitian and the U is unitary?
And the U is unitary, yeah.
Okay.
Which is why I need to worry about putting them in terms of polyproducts, because the polyproducts, you know, I can implement them, they're basically unitary, right? Which I can implement. But this X might just be Hermitian and not unitary. So I cannot just put, you know, like there.
And what is this K cos 2 omega t. Can you explain that? Where does the k come
from? The k just comes from, well, I just said, you know, I wanted to obey the commutation relations of S2. So it's been commutation relations. And that they are still orthogonal. So when you do the trace between H1 and H0 and H1, you will have like some delta and some constant. And that's the constant there. So I'm just, you know, I'm not normalizing these things so they are orthogonal. And I'm just leaving this constant around because it doesn't matter any much. It was some constant.
Is the normalization of the
operator? So if you normalize them, then it goes away?
Yeah. Yeah, that's all. Yeah, sorry about that. I just, you know, didn't want to get too much into details that maybe I'm not seeing before. But if you normalize them, they can. Okay, so let me just recap. Right? We have some, you know, this Ramsey interferometry, which for people in quantum optics is kind of classical. We saw like the GAP protocol from the 70s, which gets a better scaling by using entanglement on the initial state. Then we went to how the entire specific machine looked like, and it's actually optimal. And for the simple case of metrology, where you know the U and it's just a sigma C rotation, and where you can prepare an against the U, then that's equivalent to the sequential protocol. And all that says is that the sequential protocol is actually equivalent to the cat state protocol and is not using in time. But it has the state scale. So then what we're doing is exploring what you can use this sequential protocol, which has the same optimal scaling to the phase estimation and the simple fixes what you can do. So one thing you can do with it is just doing estimation with mixed state quantum computation. And of course it is unitized where just, you know, single qubit unitized, and you will put them there, you're gonna need the mixed state, right? Because you only need one qubit at a time. So there wouldn't be a point of using all these mixed states if there were just another, you know, one qubit. But they might be more complicated and they might be unitized against the, well, I haven't checked, you know, what's the actual experimental value of this, any, but if these are complicated unitized that you have with some molecules anymore, and you cannot make them up just to have a single of the qubit, then maybe this would be one way to estimate this parameter. But the whole point is, for unitized that have for many qubits, you can still do your estimation by kind of going to the Lie algebra feature, Heisenberg feature, and just acting with a unitary rotation polyproduct, measure the inner product with some other poly product, and because that inner product is going to change because this poly product is rotated by the effect of U, then you can use the inner product to find this angle, and from this angle just to make the parameter that you're interested. Okay, so that has been the logic that took us to this point.
So is this, when you say mixed state estimation, is it, do you mean like state tomography?
No, I mean I'm estimating this frequency here. So I'm just estimating this thing, omega t. I'm just estimating a frequency omega.
Oh, and you're using a mixed state.
And I'm using a mixed state. So instead of, you know, having to prepare, you know, a lot of entangled qubits, as it did seem, you know, for people in quantum optics, where you don't need entangled qubits, you have it sequentially. And that has been, you know, the trend lately. And now what we're saying is, well, you can even do it if the unitary is having many qubits and they're mixed, not even pure, you can even do it in that mix. So that was the conclusion of this.
So is there any difference of having a pure or mixed state on the
here?
Yeah.
Well, if it's totally mixed, then fair enough.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you just, yeah, if it's just partially polarized, then, well,
yeah, well, this, I don't care about the first two of that. I care about all the other ones.
Oh, the
other ones? The pure qubits at the bottom, you get the more efficient result.
If you're stuck with pure qubits at the bottom? Well, for this particular case, I mean, you won't get these operators. This operation, right? I mean, so it might be, you would probably be able to, you would be able to use pure qubits here, but probably this wouldn't be the best way to do it, because here we're, you know, expressing this in terms of the traces, which is the data product, but for that, if you have a mixed state, that would be hard, right? With pure states, you have to sort of know if you want to get the traces. But you can do it in a similar way, and I think it would be a problem with that.
What I'm not asking is, I agree you will use a different method if you have pure state, but if you have p qubits, and they are pure or they are mixed, do you get the same precision on estimated omega to one round of the circuit with the same number of gates or whatever?
So you will get the same scale.
The same scale.
Yeah, the same scaling with the number of resources here, which is like the total time that you're basically using in the scaling model, because the scaling that we're putting here is the optimal scaling that we learned from, you know, the optimal quantum physics estimation circuit, which is the scaling of the target circuit. We also get the same scaling with the. There might be, you know, other constants that come over here, like maybe this serotonality constant and things like that, but, you know, the scaling would be the same.
So you can do better with pure state than you can.
The scaling.
But the scaling in the number of qubits are you or the total T, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you may improve some other constant.
Yeah. On T, you can get better scaling. This is something. That's, you know, why we started with the guitar statistics. We got here. Okay, well, you can obviously simplify this thing. That was like, you know, fairly generic. But we really compose this H on a lot of polyproducts, elements. And then you have to do the cell square, which would be one of these constants that would be bad because you have to do this a lot of times, right? And the scaling would be the same, but, you know, you have a constant L square that you're losing. So a simple case would be, well, if we can find this H1, number one of H1 is that you commute with H now and it closes in an SQ200, so they just behave like spin operators. So we can find an H1 which is just a polyproduct, and it has these properties that maybe are not so important. Then it turns out that you can say where H mu 0 are is the polyproduct composition of H now, which is the thing generating the phase there that I know about. So if you find a sigma 1 polyproduct with these relations, then you can just use H1, and you only need to do this estimation 1, calculate the trace, and you get cos omega t, you only need to do that 4 times. You can do this even if the U is a black box, so you don't have fine control over the time, but you can only use the time in some discrete sets. You can do it for multi-parameter estimation, so I guess I won't say much, and what you need to do is you find this sigma here, that basically, okay, this sigma there is some value operator that you want to find. And this H naught was again the generator of this frequency, but now you have a bunch of them, and you want to estimate one of them. So if this sigma commutes with one of them and it commutes with the other, then this operator here will just have one parameter, sigma. And you might not be able to implement this, but you do a further expansion, and then everything works as you want. So this is just a thing, it's like back and hopper, it's just like the parameter, and using the promotive parameter estimation, I think, very interesting. So you can do this estimation with mixed state quantum computation, and it has those similar scaling. And then there's other things you can do with these sequential protocols, and actually they were introduced, I guess I have mentioned this before, but one of these papers, the book of Barrett, which is another previous paper that I think the book of Robert. And one of the things they wanted to do with them is synchronize friends. So you have Alice and you have Bob, and let's say, like, you know, their clocks are not synchronized here, trying to synchronize the clocks, and what they can do is they just do this sequential protocol because, well, Alice X operates here, that is, Bob X operates here in
in the picture they're using just gives you a rotation with some frequency which corresponds to how was the offset of the clock. So let me not get too much into where this is coming from, but if you leave it, that you know, the fact of the French are the cheek cracks is equivalent to if you just apply both that's one expression, that is another expression, if there are zero of these. Then the sequential protocol of first synchronization, when Alice gets the cubic, applies his sex operations as the bot, both by sex, goes back to Alice, as by sex, and so forth. Because every one of these persons gets a C rotation, is at the same sequential protocol we talked about. And you can do, of course, you can do this with increasing ones, because you know all you're saying is that, well, now I'm just going to implement this C rotation, but instead of implementing it at once, then it's just the product of some operation in Alice frame and some operation in both frames. So you do the same thing. And here you will have some operation in Alice frame and some other operation in both frames. And what we're saying is that the product of the two of them is equivalent to some unitary which has some phase that you're trying to estimate. So this is basically the same thing as we were doing before. But it looks a bit funny from here, because what you're sending between Alice and Bob, Alice keeps that zero. So what you're sending between Alice and Bob is basically the mixed state, which is not really mixed anymore, because in use process it has been slightly purified. And it's separable across this partition, so there's no entanglement between here, but there's entanglement between chunks here and chunks there. That's the world where it's deep, actually. So this is also optimal to synchronize the clocks, even though what they are sending between them is almost mixed. And there is no entanglement between the silver that Alice keeps and Bob's protocol system. But it's definitely easy. Well, and you also have to work out, you know, if the whole thing actually achieves the limit. So you have to do this, you have to change T for the different bits of the phase. And you can do that with some adaptive Bayesian protocol, but I'm not going to get into the details of that, I guess. It's not very important. It just means that you can actually achieve the scaling, so you have to check that everything works. And we have gone all the way here, and we have seen that you can use BQC1 to do phase estimation. So then, of course, one natural question that comes to mind is, well, you know, we started saying that phase estimation was BQP complete. If you do phase estimation for general problems, so can you do growers, for instance, using these kind of techniques? And it turns out that you cannot. So you can do phase estimation for some unitaries in BQC1, but you cannot do this phase estimation for all unitaries, or at least not in this one. And this is the, well, this is not really a proof. This is an outline of how you see it, and actually is using this technique from this paper, Neil and Laflamme, where they introduced the BQC1 model. So the point is that if you have some unitary that it basically looks like, this is just the Kroeber oracle, if you put theta equal pi, all these things will do what this notation means. It will put a minus one on some S state, which is the solution to your Kroeber problem, and it will leave all the other states on the computational basis unchanged. And the question that you can ask in Grover is, like, is there a solution? So they give me a black box which implements this unitary, and it's going to put a phase of pi in some state on the computational basis. And there is no solution, and the Grover thing is just not changing anything. And you want to distinguish between these two cases. That's one way to formulate what it means to implement Grover. So you want to distinguish, you know, these two black boxes, basically. And this is the most generic thing you can do, which is use the Grover. You start with some state which is partially, it just has the, you know, one pure qubit, which is then sealed as the sigma c, and then you do whatever generic unitaries you want. Those are the W's that are totally unspecified. And then you're going to put this oracle here, which can be either this one, so there is a solution, or this one, so there is no solution. And if you work around, then you find that the difference between this expectation value not having a solution and the expectation value when there is a solution decreases exponentially, which basically means that you will have to do this a number of times, which is called like 2n, which is not Grover. Well, Grover will be the square root of 2n. So all I'm saying here is that you can do. No, I was just saying you can do phase estimation with some unit that's not at all. This is one example you can
I just wanted to check whether I understood what. This is, and what you're saying is that if you only have one clean qubit and you want to do something like a Grover search, then because you know the other qubits are in a total mixed state, once you prove that you can't get the quadratic speed up, than you would in Grover's.
Yeah, at least not this way. Actually, this is a more generic
object.
No, sorry. Yeah, this is generic. This is, if you want to distinguish these black holes from these black holes,
it can't be done anyway.
It can't be done anyway, because these W's here are not specified. And that's basically contained in this paper here. This is just that this is specialized for, you know,
so you're saying by calculating this expectation value, you cannot make a distinction?
Correct. So the expectation values are of this thing here when you have no solution, and this thing here when you have a solution. And the expectation value is what you get from these arrays in this are very close, are so close that you cannot distinguish them unless you do this a number of times, which is scales worse than you cover on a quantum computer. Which comes from your paper.
That's why I'm puzzled. So I'm puzzled because usually in the QST1 model there's an implicit assumption that we have a classical computer next to it who helps you. And if we can simulate quantum mechanics efficiently, then we should be able to do Grover that way. That's what we did. You just forget about the fact that you have EQC1, you just use a classical computer.
Not sure on this.
So in EQC1, you always have a classical computer.
Okay.
And suppose that somebody finds a way to simulate quantum mechanics efficiently with a classical computer.
Yeah.
Then it can do it Grover with a classical computer.
Yeah, but you still, I mean, if the black box is, it's in this abstract black box model, yeah. So the number of queries is still proportional to the data base size.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. All right. So I'm not going to change the subjects a bit. So we have argued that this approaching protocol has optimal scaling, right? We have argued that even with decoherences, it still looks as good as the cut-state protocol and the other way around. The cut-state protocol with initial entanglement doesn't do better or worse than this one. They're totally equivalent. And so we've been working with this sequential protocol, right? And we have argued that you can implement the sequential protocol and get optimal scaling for some unitaries using the BQC1 model. And now we're gonna try to do something else. So we're gonna, with this was the most generic thing that you can do in a standard phase estimation from the beginning, right? And from the beginning, this is the most generic thing you can do. You can have some preparation procedure, and then you can have but this is not the most generic thing, but this is the one that has been considered until now. You have some preparation procedure. Then you have,
so you're back in the quantum metrology.
Yeah, back page one, want to go. Generic phase estimation. And this is what has been considered for generic phase estimation. You have some preparation procedure, then you have these product unitaries, right? So they are acting in the qubits. They're not very popular or anything like that. Every one of them is acting in a different qubit. You generate some phase, then you have some general measurement, and you want to estimate this phase with these measurements optimally, and that's what they have proved, like in this paper, Van Damme, Mosca, I forget people probably. That the optimal way to do it is basically equivalent to this Kitaj protocol for some cost functions anyway, to this Kitaj protocol that I presented at the beginning. So what we're going to do now is try to generalize this a little bit more and see what happens. And this is the generalizations we're going to do. Instead of having these unitaries that act on the qubits and give you the phase, we're going to have like a big unitary acting on all the qubits at the same time, with some generator H that right now I'm leaving unspecified, but then we'll talk about what generators make things put in there. So if I put an H here, that is just H1 plus H2 plus H3 to Hn, and just back to this case, but maybe we can put some other H there. So let's leave that question open. And something else I can try to do, I guess, is put ancillas here, right? And that maybe they help on the preparation procedure or the measurement procedure. So maybe you will get a better scaling in some situations. So this will be more general, right? I don't think you can do anything more general than this, really, to attack this problem of phase estimation. So the first simplification we can do is to argue that the ancillas here, whatever you do with ancillas, even if you know this is in the continuous time and you have some ancillas and some Hamiltonian ancillas that is changing with time and is coupling with this qubit, it doesn't matter what you do with ancillas. As long as the ancillas are not affected by this unitary that gives you the phase, the optimal scaling that you get is not improved, right? So, well, did you prove that using this information? And
not quite equation there is that
I didn't mean that the scaling is
for both those unitaries. Yes.
It might help, you know, for practical reasons, it might help to do the experiment, you might get better measurements, but the sensitivity of this full circuit and this this the sensitivity you will get when using gates like this or gates like this is the same, so you can just forget about this. So I'm going to don't improve the beauty of the scale. And I'm just left with this. Right? I don't have to see it anymore.
So, well, what I will say is that some other Hamiltonians that some other phase generators that makes us considering are nonlinear generators at this point, where you have this HJ acting on every qubit, but you raise it to some k power. And this is equivalent to just saying that you have this product here of HJ1, HJ2, so every one of them is acting on a different qubit, but the indexes, J's, are going between all the qubits. So what this means physically is that in this particular case, you have a k-body coupling, so the coupling is affecting k qubits at the same time, and you're coupling all of them, right? Not only the ones that are nearest neighbors, but all the qubits at the same time, right? Which then will, I mean, you can actually do for k equals 2, that will come later, or, but it's a case that makes sense considering, if not for anything else, because it's well-defined and it might be interesting more directly. So with this definition for the generator, what the scaling do you get? Well, there are n to the k terms here, and that's basically the reason why you get a better scaling. And the way to prove it formally, the way we did it anyway, you can probably do it with the polynomial method, which I haven't tried, but is to use the Cramer-Rao inequality, which is this inequality coming from statistics that basically tells you what's the fundamental scaling that you can get for the estimation of a parameter. So just, you know, believe me that that's the case. And if you do the Cramer-Rao inequality, which I don't have time to do here, obviously, then what you find is that the uncertainty of the estimator at this frequency, so phi was omega times t, is inversely proportional to the number of times you repeat this circuit, that's the nu as before, the time that was in the phase, and the variance of the generator for the initial state, which is actually upper bounded by something that just looks like the difference between the highest and lowest eigenvalue of this generator. So this is the fundamental limit. And what is not very hard to see is that if you use this and then you use a generator that has this k-body coupling where all the particles are acting with all the particles, then you get a scaling that goes like, because the difference between eigenvalues goes like n to the k, and the estimation of your frequency goes like 1 over n to the k, which is better than what we were getting before, which was 1 over n. Right? So this is the more generic thing we can do. And if you use nonlinear generators, you get better scalings on the estimation of the frequency. All right. Then, of course, another question you can ask is what happens if instead of allowing a full general preparation procedure, which includes entangling the initial state, you restrict yourself to prepare some initial state which is separable. And if you do that, and I guess I'm kind of short of time, if you do that, then you can prove, again using Cramer-Rao, that what you get is instead of 1 over n to the k, and I didn't put the square root of nu here because that's just the number of times you repeat the circuit that always stays the same, it's just classical statistics. Then the uncertainty that you get goes with the time as before, and instead of n to the k, as you have with the optimal entangled input state, if you restrict yourself to a product state, you get n to the k minus 1. So what this shows is that entanglement in the initial state always gives you an improvement that goes like 1 over the square root of n, instead of, you know, buying you a quadratic improvement that you could think of on the estimation. It always buys you a 1 over square root of n improvement. So in this case, for k equals 2, let's say, you get 1 over n to the 3 half, which is better than 1 over n, which is what you will get if you use the standard separable gates and the sequential protocol on the initial entangled protocol, which is better. So if you can get one of these Hamiltonians, for instance, uc squared, then you're doing a better scaling than you can do with entangled and the separable H. And, okay, I should say that there are, you know, people pursuing that. So this is a paper that argues how you can get this JC square and an optical system and an atomic spin cloud. And these two other papers argue that you can get the same JC square with Bose-Einstein condensates, spin or Bose-Einstein condensates. So you can get, supposedly, you know, according to these results, you can get JC square in nature, at least for some system size. So if you get a JC square, then it's interesting to analyze what will happen and actually, you know, do the whole thing, like what initial state would you need, what measurement would you need. And, well, if you just look, if you start with an state, which is a coherent state, so this is going to be my initial state. I'm just putting all the spins, so all the qubits as the spins in the same direction. And that just gives me a coherent state, which is just the spin J pointing in some direction in some big block sphere. And if I start with my spinning seed here, right, and I rotate it some amount beta, so that's this operation. These are just angular momentum operators. I don't have any initial expectation value of JY. I just measure JY on this spin coherent state. If I look at the evolution of my expectation value of JY for different phases, then forget about this. You can get the exact expression. What you get is something that basically is rotating as it will rotate if it was just one spin with JC. But instead of rotating with some omega T, so frequency omega, you get this this extra J here, at least at initial small phi. So which means that you're rotating J times faster than you will rotate if you use one of these separable generators. So because you're rotating J time faster, that's basically one way to understand why you get this J to the 3 halves. Otherwise, it would be like, this is a separable input state, so you will get the square root of J, because the length of this spin is proportional to the number of spins you have, right? So instead of getting a square root of J, because you're rotating J time faster, then you get J to the 3 halves. And you get this better scale. So you can work it out, you know, and see that it works with one of these very simple initial coherent states, and just measuring the expectation value of J1. And that's why these papers are talking about how to do this in practice, maybe with a Bose-Einstein condensate. The hard part, of course, is getting this Hamiltonian. But if you get the Hamiltonian, then you can try to do this estimation. So this will be, well, I guess I'm running out of time, right? Yeah, okay. Well, so these are some plots. This will be the optimal scaling, and that's how JY evolves. I guess I want to describe. And the only thing I want to say here is that if you approximate this with that, this is like the actual JY expectation value. If you approximate it with an initial, with a cohesion state rotating getting faster, you get these blue lines. So a coherent state rotating just getting faster gives you measurements on, sorry, this is JX, on JY, which are these ones, or JX, which looks like the ones you actually get. Except that, you know, you have like some defacing of the different components. So you can analyze this effectively for a small file. If a coherent state rotating J times faster, it goes well with the coherence, so you don't lose this scaling there. So the scaling is robust against the coherence. You don't seem to get a lot of entanglement. And I guess I'll finish there because I'm running out of time. So I guess the conclusions I want to present is that the sequential and entangled protocols are formally related. Those are all the arguments we were given at the beginning, starting, you know, with three-coded entities, the optimal phase estimation in quantum computation and stuff like that. And they behave the same way if you put the coherence. So it's not just three-coded entities. Actually, if you put the coherence, they look the same. So physically, there is something there, right? Because, well, the coherence is noise, which will occur in reality. The sequential protocol, then, which is simpler than the other one, apparently, or at least simpler to implement, you can do it with DQC1, with often, so for a lot of unitaries, not all of them, so the Grover Oracle, you cannot do it. then you can go a bit farther and ask, you know, what happens if you put these nonlinear Hamiltonians, and you see that you can get a better scaling if you can do those kind of Hamiltonians. And even if you put a separable input state, and even if you put noise, you get a scaling that goes better than what you get with this separable Hamiltonian. So that's why some people is interested maybe in doing this experiment with those kinds of Hamiltonians. And I guess I'll leave it there, I think.
What do you mean by the linear?
I mean, something like this. JC is a spin operator acting on a load. So you have single qubits, you're going to spin 100 and single, right? And then a typical JC operator will rotate all the qubits independently. But if you have this JC square operator, which is also squeezing Hamiltonian, it's not just protecting all the qubits independently, it's rotating them on some
qubits.
No, that's not linear. You put that linear and then you take what's one. Right? Would be like,
it's a linear operator.
It's just a matrix.
So can you just say why you might expect such a coupling to exist naturally?
Why
might I expect such a coupling? I mean, this wouldn't be any use if I had to put in extra effort anyway, right? So what? What systems have this property and why do they have it?
Well, one would be possible, I think, having to do with the coupled sets, reportable discounts, but in terms of particle pair, localized, directly localized bosons. So they see every other boson dependency, you have a boson dependency. So that would be one reason why you get these JC squared, because they're talking to each other. There are other systems we're looking at. There's this, this optical spin cloud that Jay is working with, and that has to do with you have a cloud of atoms, and then you put some laser through, and the interaction between the atoms and the laser is collected. So the laser is that kind of seen as one, which is individual atoms. And then what you access, keep access through some mirrors, and the same light from the laser comes back through the spin cloud. So it kind of works like a quantum box. So every atom is talking to its light, which is a quantum box, and the quantum box comes through, and then we have the interaction with the quantum box left or key. So it's a physics that they should be scared. And there are some other systems that are looking at, but that's not going to be the issue this one.
Can I just pick up on that? But also, since you're looking at RK equals 2, or do you have.
No, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it looks like three particle interactions, and I think they are generally small.
Yeah.
If you look at classical mythology, is there a nonlinear Hamiltonian? Do you believe?
Classical mythology with nonlinear Hamiltonian. What do you mean by classical mythology? That starts. Productive of the state, several measurement, or?
Yeah, your first, one of your first.
So that's this case. That's the last case. So a classical, in the sense of you don't put a fragment of the initial state and you don't do collective measurements?
No, I mean, I have a bunch of atoms that don't talk to each other and you don't agree with the rule of quantum mechanics, the same way as the clocks are set, really, in, at NEST.
Also, so they don't talk. Well, then you don't have this non-linear Hamiltonian, right? Because the reason why what you get is because every atom is talking to every other one. That's what gives you the sense of the case. If they only talk to the nearest neighbors, then you get the same scaling as you had before. You get the improvement in the scaling has to do with these long-range interactions, or I should just say interactions between all qubits. All the speeds in the system, everyone talking with everybody. If you don't have that, then you don't get that. You just don't get it.
I can write a nonlinear oscillator, right? No, it does have an exclusive form.
Oh, I see.
I'd say, suppose I have some bunch of particles which have some kind of interaction there, which pass upon the time. Would you get an improvement?
If you just write a classical Hamiltonian with a slip code. Well, you might need some radius ones. I think you might. I haven't checked. But you know, it's kind of a trick to compare quantum systems with classical systems. Well, you know, you just have like one bit of information per qubit here. So that's like a constraint you have to carry out when you're trying to do this comparison. If you don't do that, then you may be compared with something that, you know, has a lot more bits of information per qubit. So it's not really the same thing. Maybe.
Why do you put seemingly in a smaller font?
Well, I jumped at that, and it's because we're working at it. So we have some bounds and entanglement that you generate. So what we have is, if you have this n spin 1/2, and then you just look up entanglement between one of them and all the rest, then we can carry this with whatever amount epsilon of entanglement, not quite so, but any epsilon. But if you have like bigger partitions, then we're getting more entanglements, so the map is not that good. So we're working on improving on trying to do this within a less entanglement. To be able to say that you don't need entanglements, we have an epsilon. I mean, the partitions that we actually have further one entanglement, which is not good.
To me, the interesting question is how much. Even if there's a very small amount, does it increase? Because you increase the size of the system.
For small partitions, but if you divide it in half, so it's you have your n, and you go like n half and n half, then the buffer will have to increase. So one, speak with all the others, that amount is constant, and it doesn't increase with the size of the system. But in-house and in-house, the partitions get bigger. And then the entanglement we're getting there, so far, less predictable by what we're
working for. It also depends on how deep into this bit-by-bit adaptive protocol you are. So if the phase, if you're only trying to measure the last few bits of the phase, so that the total phase is actually very small, then the bound, even with the equal bipartition, does not grow with the existence. So it sort of depends on how you ask the question, too. That's why it's thank you.
Yeah, from this, what should we conclude about the power of quantum computation, the origin of the power of quantum computation? Or what did you conclude?
Well, that's a good question. To start with, I did a lot of simplifications on I assume like I'm preparing an eigenstate. And if you do that, then you can not do a source algorithm for instance. You cannot prepare an eigenstate of the unitary for the first place. So you cannot conclude much in general because this is a restricted case. But for this restricted case, one question I don't know how to answer quite yet is just one single qubit. Is there because he has this optimal escape that people in quantum optics describe as the Heisenberg limit, and they say it's a target where people you need a target and you don't need to do things that way. You just need one qubit and you just have longer because you just have this coherent evolution and the decoherence is the same. So, what's quantum on just one single qubit? And there are actually, papers out there that deal with the quantumness of just one single qubit. This would be another quantum cube of one qubit, also unitary quantum. So I guess it's related to the frequency of one thing, because you have only one qubit there, and the rest is a total mix of quasi and state, for instance.
Okay. It's time to sit here again.